Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, December 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Cusack, continuing his work for over four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction. VillaVeritas.org. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Eric Plakin. He is the medical director and CEO of the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and is here to discuss mental health. The number to call with your questions is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org, but the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Plakin and your calls coming up right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today to discuss mental health is Dr. Eric Plakin. He is the medical director and CEO of the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. He is a board-certified psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, researcher, and forensic psychiatrist. He earned his medical degree from the Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons. If you want to be a part of today's conversation, give us a call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet us at WAMCVoxPop or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Coming to us from snowy Stockbridge, Dr. Plakin, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Thanks, Ray. It's nice to be back, and it was an easier commute doing it.
How much snow do you have out that way?
Oh, we only have about 8 or 9 inches. I hear the hill towns here got a foot and a half.
Yeah, and there's more on the way, I'm told. It looks that way out front of the studio here. What does a forensic psychiatrist do?
Well, forensic psychiatrists are psychiatrists who work in a legal domain, in the courtroom, or doing work in relation to a legal case. It's the application of psychiatric principles to legal matters. One of the places where this comes up is in criminal issues, where there's sometimes a question raised about whether someone charged with a crime is competent to stand trial or whether they're criminally responsible. And then other times these involve malpractice cases, for example. In psychiatry, it's did a medication cause a side effect, or was a person's suicide the fault of a treating clinician? And sometimes it has to do with issues of social policy and advocacy. So, for example, a couple of years ago, I was involved in a pretty important class action lawsuit out in San Francisco in federal court that has to do with access to care in terms of whether insurance companies were actually using the right standards to determine whether someone needed care, whether the care was so-called medically necessary.
This is a fascinating topic. Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest, and we talk mental health today on Vox Pop Medical Monday. The case you mentioned, or a generic case you mentioned, where you might be called in to ascertain whether someone who committed suicide had been the victim of malpractice, that strikes me as one that would be very tough to prove.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a question of sorting out what's the reasonable expectation of care that is provided by somebody depending on the situation that they're in, and did the clinical people make the right decisions? You know, we'd like to believe that psychiatrists, psychologists, others in the mental health world have the capacity to predict events like suicide, but it's really hard. There are all kinds of, for example, epidemiologic risk factors that is population-based things that we know make someone more likely to commit suicide. And if you have a bunch of them, that raises the risk of someone committing suicide from about 1 in 10,000 to about maybe 1 in 100. Well, that's still a kind of a long shot. And if you had even more and you got it down to 1 in 10, well, that's still 9 chances in 10 that it wouldn't happen. So it's a complicated and difficult domain. And, you know, so some of my work is in the world of forensic psychiatry, but most of it is clinical, and certainly running the Austin Riggs Center and taking us through our 100th anniversary celebration is a big deal, and actually WAMC was one of our corporate sponsors in that event. We had quite a big conference last September at Tanglewood at the brand new Lindy Center, and had international speakers from around the world helping us think together about the mental health crisis in America and how to try to fix some of the things that are broken.
All right, let's stop right there. That's a great spot. Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest today. Mental health is the topic. 800-348-2551 is the number. Why is there a mental health crisis in America? How do you quantify that?
Well, quantify is pretty easy. For example, only 40% of people with mental illness actually saw a clinical person in the last year. Only 60% of those with what's called serious mental illness, 15 to 20% of the population of jails these days are people with significant mental disorders. There are a lot of ways that people in need of care are not getting it. We're here in Berkshire County, in one of the places in the state of Massachusetts where, we have twice the opioid addiction rate of Boston. And it's high everywhere and, you know, throughout the nation and in a lot of places. We have a high suicide rate. There's a lot of ways that there is difficulty getting access to care, getting continuity of care, and sometimes also with the nature of the care that's provided. You know, psychiatry is not one of those specialties that can be conducted very well with a doctor speaking to a computer rather than to a patient, you know, right, looking at the computer and entering data and having just a few minutes. I mean, this depends on relationship. Relationships are tremendously important and part of what we know is going to make a difference. So back in September when we had this this centennial conference for Riggs, this was our focus. What can we think together about that might make a difference?
Now, you say what you seem to be describing is a mental health care crisis, but going back to the mental health crisis, are the numbers drastically higher that now, as you see them, than they were, say, 75 years ago?
Are the numbers of people with mental disorders higher?
Yes, the percentage of the population.
You know, it probably in some ways, yes, but it's very complicated. I think we have had some considerable success in fighting stigma. You see far more these days on, for example, television or other social media. You see far more of people who are celebrities being willing to come forth about their own struggles with mental disorders or substance use disorders of one sort or another. And that increases the willingness of people to enter treatment and therefore to be counted. So it's a little hard to say whether absolute numbers are increased because of a greater prevalence of mental disorders. But it's true that more people are coming forward and seeking treatment. And one thing we do know is that although in the rest of the developed world, the so-called diseases of despair are decreasing, in this country, they are increasing. And the diseases of despair, if I'm remembering them right, are suicidal overdoses, opioid addiction, and alcoholic cirrhosis, liver disease due to alcohol. These are called the diseases of despair, and the United States is quite unusual in their being on the increase rather than decreasing as they are elsewhere in the world. We live in stressful times, as anyone who listens to WAMC knows from the course of the news in the that unfolds.
Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest today from the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Austin Riggs Center just celebrating its 100th anniversary. Let's grab a call or two before the first break, Doctor. 800-348-2551 is our number. If you have a question on mental health today, Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Do personality disorders ever morph into more serious mental issues?
That's a great question, Jim. Do personality disorders morph into other issues? So here's what we're learning. So first of all, what's a personality disorder? A personality disorder is a habitual way of interacting with people that well, there are 8 or 9 different personality disorders, but a frequently diagnosed one is called borderline personality disorder. And there you see uncertainty about one's personal identity. You see impulsivity. You see difficulty tolerating being alone. You see often alternating extremes in views of people as either all good or all bad. There's a range of things. And these personality traits become significant enough that they interfere with the ability to function in relationships with people or in a work role. So that's what a personality disorder is. And these are really much more who the person is than a set of symptoms that seems to have had an onset and then an endpoint. The fact is, I've spoken to many people with mental disorders who say, first, they diagnosed me with an anxiety disorder. Then they said I had depression. Then they said I was bipolar. Then they said I had a personality disorder. Darn it, who was right? And the answer often is everyone. That is, although we would very much like to believe that there's one person who has one disorder, and we've put a lot of work into developing this instrument called DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 5th edition. The fact is, most people have more than one disorder. So, in fact, when someone has a personality disorder, there's a good likelihood that they either do now or will in the future have other disorders. So it's not so much that the personality disorder morphs into other disorders, but that the personality disorder may be the leading edge of the blossoming of a series of disorders. And this is not at all uncommon. In a very large research study done across multiple sites, it's called the STAR-D study, and I'm never going to quite remember what the initials stand for. It's something like Sequence Treatment Alternative Regimen or something like that, but it's STAR-D, so it's for people who present with depression.
Yeah.
When you look at that group of people who said, hey, I'm depressed, between 75 and 80% had more than one disorder. And those people actually had more complicated courses. So it's less an issue, Jim, of people morphing than of the full range of things that someone may be struggling with manifesting itself over time.
Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest. It's Medical Monday, Mental Health Today. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop, Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest today. Dr. Plakin is the medical director and CEO of the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, celebrating 100 years. You ever see any of the documentation, Doc, and pictures from the old days, way back when?
Oh yes, absolutely. We have some wonderful archives that are part of our effort to preserve that history. And in fact, on our website, if people go to austinriggs.org, it's AustenRiggs.org, there's access to the some of the some of the photos and a video we did narrated by Sam Waterston that was part of our centennial celebration. Right in downtown Stockbridge, one of the buildings that Riggs owns is what used to be the Corner House. It was the original site of the Norman Rockwell Museum in town, and we now own that, and we put together an exhibit on the history of Riggs in American and really world psychiatry, have a number of photos there. Of course, that's that was something we ran from the summer into October, but it's going to be open again this next weekend when the Stockbridge winter recreation of the Norman Rockwell Main Street occurs. We'll have that open, so if any of your listeners turn up in Stockbridge, they shouldn't hesitate to head down to the Corner House, which is right next to the post office on Main Street.
You know, given
but
all,
yes, we have wonderful old photos.
Given all the progress that has been made throughout the medical industry as far as treatments and cures and prevention, what are some of the ways the treatments have improved, if you will, for the most common mental illnesses, say, from 100 years ago to today?
Well, let's see. We certainly have made important gains. We are a lot better at studying treatments. We have a lot of evidence of the efficacy of a range of medications and of psychotherapies of various kinds, a psychotherapy being a relationship used as an agent of change. And I think that it's quite clear that we have made a lot of progress. We understand a lot more about the brain. We spent about 25 years since the beginning of the age of the brain was declared by the first President Bush back in the 90s. We know a lot more about it, but the other side of the coin is that in spite of all those gains, there's no replacement for the importance of a human relationship as part of what helps someone get better. And there are real limitations to our treatments. Even though they work, they're also limited. You know, Jim's question a few minutes ago that led to a discussion of the fact that people have often more than one disorder at the same time or over time is part of what makes it complicated, that the fact is that that we test our medications and our therapies on patients who have just one disorder, but most people who turn up, close to 4 out of 5, it isn't quite that simple. They have more than one thing going on. Maybe in addition to their personality disorder, depression, and maybe they have a substance use disorder at the same time. So there are real gains, but there's a certain quality. I sometimes like to borrow the term from that movie from a couple of decades ago. There's a certain Back to the Future quality of some of what we're discovering. That is, we hoped we would find the genes that are responsible for major mental disorders like schizophrenia and depression and panic disorder. It turns out, though, that when we look, there are not genes that are, you know, 2 or 3 that account for schizophrenia or depression. Instead, the little bits of genetic material that are associated with major mental disorders like schizophrenia, for example, well, there's about 250 of those. And for depression, there's about 40 or so little bits of genetic influence. And so it's very complicated. And so what was once a belief that we would figure out that genes equal disease has changed and become a recognition that it's really gene by environment interaction that causes disease and is also associated with maintaining health. So that old question of is it nature or nurture that accounts for mental disorders turns out to have an answer. Well, it's both. And if you look at either in isolation, you're going to be missing an important part of the picture. So we often speak about this gene by environment interaction way of thinking of things as important. And there's an older term that means roughly the same thing, and it's one we use a lot at Riggs. It's biopsychosocial. I mean, that's a mouthful to say, but what it's really suggesting is, look, if you want to understand the causation of mental disorders and if you want to understand their treatment, you have to look at the biology, the psychology, and the social context. biopsychosocial. That's a term that goes back to the 1970s, and I think it's as relevant today as it ever was.
Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest. He is the medical director and CEO of the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Maggie in Pine Bush. Maggie, you're on.
Hi. My family was the victim of a crime by a distant family member who was mentally ill, a young man who had had multiple hospitalizations. It was a very serious crime. And he has bounced back and forth between mental hospitals and jail awaiting a trial because he has been found, you know, mentally incompetent, and then he's found competent. And anyhow, we're awaiting a trial, and he's not declaring himself to be guilty by reason of insanity. So if he's found guilty, which he will be, he'll go to state prison. And it's very, you know, I mean, we were obviously, we have to protect ourselves. It was, you know, we are still, you know, at risk. But on the other hand, it's like he doesn't really belong in a state prison. He's seriously mentally ill. And it's just a uncomfortable, you know, there's not really a proper place for him once he's found guilty. I don't know.
It's a terrible, sad story, Maggie. I'm sorry to hear that your family was victimized that way. And there's so many pieces to what you've raised. Let me see if I can address some of them, and you tell me if there's more you are asking. But first of all, people with mental disorders are far more likely to be the victim of violence or criminal behavior than the perpetrators. We have to watch out. It's part of stigma to load everything about the awful problem we're having with gun violence, for example, in this country, and see that as simply a question of mental illness. I don't know whether gun violence was part of what happened. It's beside the point. I'm just illustrating a point that, you know, if we could get rid of all of the violence perpetrated by people with mental illness in this country, we would have reduced it by 4%. 96% of it is not by people with mental disorders. But here you have a situation where a family member who sounds like he or she has a serious mental illness did something, and the legal authorities had reason to question whether this person knew what he was doing and understood that a crime had been committed, had a position about the crime, and was able to work with a lawyer. And those are the kinds of issues that a forensic psychiatrist is asked to assess in determining whether someone is competent to stand trial. Someone has to have a basic understanding of the charges against them. They have to have a position with respect to those charges. They have to be able to explain something about how they're thinking about it and work with an attorney in order to be able to be on trial. And it sounds like, for whatever reasons, this has been in question, and then often what happens is such a person receives treatment, they improve, and now they're competent to stand trial, and you know, then they may stop medications or something like that and lose competence. But it sounds right. Like you're heading for a trial.
Yeah.
And then there is the option of this person saying, look, I am not guilty by reason of insanity, but the chances of that actually succeeding in a trial are quite low. It comes up in only a few percent of cases, and only about.
Right. And he doesn't even want to do that.
He's saying there's nothing wrong with me, or words to that effect.
Actually, he doesn't want to. He actually, because he's been in so many mental hospitals, he doesn't want to be in a mental hospital. He would rather be in prison. But that's what he says. But that's not really where he belongs. I mean.
Right. And so he's at risk to become one of the 15 to 20% of people in prisons who have serious mental illness.
Right.
And that is hardly a place where a civilized society wants to handle its people who are not so much criminals as suffering from mental disorders. Now, you know, again, I don't know the nature of the crime, and it sounds like it's probably good for society that this person not be walking around at risk to hurt other people.
Absolutely.
But is prison really the right answer?
All right, Maggie, thanks a lot. We have to leave it there. Our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest. And Dr. Plakin, you just mentioned that if we took away all the violence perpetrated by so-called mentally ill, we would reduce it by 4%. How do you come upon that number?
This was from a report that was done that looked at I think it's looking specifically at gun violence, that 3-5% of people who, so I picked 4%, which is solidly in the middle.
Sure, sure.
3-5% of gun violence is perpetrated by people with mental disorders. And so if we could remove all of that, we would have only reduced gun violence by about 4%.
And yet, according to the statistics you cite, 15-20% of those incarcerated have a serious mental illness.
Yes, but they're not in. But people don't wind up in prison because of gun violence primarily. They wind up in prison because the way our social safety net is set up now, there is very little access to care for people who have limited resources. You know, we live in a nation in which there's great wealth and great poverty, and the divide is increasing. Now, certainly there are people who can manage to get treatment at a facility like Riggs that's internationally known and get very high quality care. There's no guarantee they're going to improve any more than there is that if you get treatment for cancer that you're going to survive. But you do the best you can and you hope for the best. Whereas in many instances, there are people who just lack the resources, and our social safety nets are terrible. I mean, one of the tragedies is how little care is available to people, how long the waiting lists are to get the treatment. One of our speakers at the Centennial Conference last September was Anita Everett, who is a former president of the American Psychiatric, and currently she's the chief medical officer of SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration in Washington. And she had an interesting analogy. She talked about the mental health treatment system as being like a black box, and there are problems at the front door to the black box. People can't get in. There are problems at the back door of the black box. That is, it's very easy to fall out of care, to lose continuity of care, to have trouble with a discharge plan being implemented in a way that's successful. And there's also trouble in the black box. There are serious limitations with the treatments that we provide. This is not, by the way, an anti-psychiatry stance. I mean, I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the American Psychiatric Association representing New England and Eastern Canada. I mean, I'm a card-carrying member of the American Psychiatric Association,
right,
one might say. But these are frank realities, that there are real issues that we need to find a way to mobilize the people and the resources to make a difference. The mental health parity law that was passed in 2008 is a huge and important step, but it's 11 years later, and it is still far from implemented. There are serious issues in access to care that are being engaged in both from the top down and from the bottom up. When I say top down, I mean there are efforts being made to improve the mental health parity law. In our neighboring state of Connecticut, Senator Chris Murphy has introduced the Mental Health Parity Compliance Act, which will force insurance companies to show how they are doing in meeting the requirements of the parity law. The idea being that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and, you know, what corporation or individual is going to buy a policy that they see isn't in compliance with the law? And then in addition to those top-down legislative pressures, there are also important bottom-up pressures, class action lawsuits, as I mentioned earlier. And one important one is this one called Witt versus United Behavioral Health, in which the judge, Joseph Spiro, a federal district court judge in California, basically said in his 106-page verdict that the insurance company, the nation's largest, was missing the mark and using the wrong criteria to determine whether someone needed care. They were only paying attention to whether there was a crisis and not to what the long-term needs of a person.
All right, let's take a quick break here. Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll get to your calls in a moment on Vox Pop. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Joined today by Dr. Eric Plakin, Medical Director and CEO of the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And Lisa in West Hurley's been waiting a while. Lisa, you're on.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for this opportunity. My mother was institutionalized in the 40s as a result of losing her father when she was four, a sexual assault, a baby out of wedlock, told to keep it all secret. My father had no idea. So when she did again have episodes, she was then again institutionalized in various facilities, psychiatric hospitals, halfway houses throughout the Hudson Valley. That continued most of her, all of her adult life. She did, was able to visit her mother in California, had another episode. I was asked to go out there. And I went to the Yellow Pages, found a MICA rehab, mentally ill, chemical abusive. She had self-medicated with alcohol, and then once the psychotropic drugs, she would choose her favorites. And I drove her to San Diego to this facility. And for the first time in her life, she became responsible for herself. And the situation that they created was the cooperative housing, where she lived in a house with five other people. They would have daily meetings in the morning to discuss any kind of issues that developed, living together, as we all know. And they would, talk these out and work them out. She learned how to balance a checkbook. She learned how to, take care of grocery shopping, to the point when she got out, maybe a year, 2 years later, she ended up taking care of her mother until she died. Huh. And what saddens me is that I wished that, she's gone 10 years now, but I wished in New York that they had had similar facilities. So I was curious what yours does. And my last question has to do with, if we were to stop treating by substance name, say alcoholism, opioid, and just say, let's treat trauma, would we encompass a majority of these people?
Wow, what a terrific set of questions, Lisa. You tell a really heartbreaking but in a way all too familiar story of your mother being in the hospital and struggling after carrying these awful secrets in her life and losses, the death of her father, a sexual assault, a baby out of wedlock. And it sounds like these things were the kind of adverse childhood experiences, not all of them in childhood, having a baby obviously was a bit later, but these kinds of adverse experiences, especially adverse childhood experiences, we are learning play a very powerful role in the onset of mental disorders. The more of these kind of adverse experiences you have, the more mental disorders you're likely to have, the more medical disorders you're likely to have, and even early death is predicted by these experiences. This is what I was addressing a bit earlier when we talk about gene by environment interaction. It's not only what's in your genes, it's also the things that happen to you. And traumatic and adverse things have a powerful impact on us. It's terrific that she was able eventually to find a way to what sounds like a place that gave her a sense of community, where there were meetings where they could talk about things that perhaps, it sounds like she had been raised in a place in which the message was don't talk about the problems. But mm-hmm. Riggs is the same way. We work very hard at trying to speak the unspoken so that it does not become the unspeakable, and trying to help people find a way to discover their voice to engage around these problems. And it also sounds like the place she found in San Diego also focused on helping her manage life skills, not only so that she could balance a checkbook and shop for herself, but later in life she could care for the mother who with whom she'd had probably such a complicated relationship in a way that almost sounds like it may have been a kind of a happy ending. I think your last point about the importance of recognizing trauma and the role it plays is incredibly important. You know, we've been looking right, left, up, and down for biomarkers, biological markers of mental disorders. We've not found them. It's sometimes likened to the search for the Holy Grail back in the King Arthur stories. You know, one looks for it and never finds it. But this business of traumatic experience, I think of as a kind of enviromarker. With the presence of those traumatic experiences, sexual abuse, neglect, loss, deaths early in life, it's simply profound and powerful. Many people have the resilience to move on, beyond it. Others are caught and stuck in situations that become terrible. And I completely agree with the course that you laid out. What finally made a big difference for her was being in a community where people could talk about the problems and be human beings with one another. That set of relationships and being in a community is an essential and valuable part of treatment approaches. Whatever wonderful medications we have, whatever wonderful therapies, relationships and communities mean a huge amount.
Eric Plakin is our guest, Dr. Eric Plakin. Lisa, thank you for the call. This email came in from Nan in Wilton, and then we'll get back to the calls. Nan writes, is there a mental disorder that current pop culture calls highly sensitive personalities, especially in children, sensitive to sound, sight, scratchy clothing, aversion to foods because of color, texture, super sensitive to other people's emotions, easily overwhelmed by crowds, too much information, etc.? Can you suggest ways to help four-year-olds? And that's from Nan in Wilton.
That's interesting, an interesting question. It's a little bit hard to tell for sure, but what Nan is describing sounds very much like a four-year-old who may be on the autism spectrum.
Ah.
That is an excessive sensitivity to sounds or colors or the seams inside the socks that one wears. And this kind of thing can be a very mild manifestation.
Okay.
Of autism spectrum disorders. Some of them have picked up names that aren't so much in the formal diagnostic manual, nonverbal learning disability and this sort of thing. But I would think of these as in that autism spectrum. Autism is a broad spectrum from things that are fairly mild to things that can be quite severe and disabling. And this sounds like it's something that may be in that range.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Jason in Albany. Jason, you're on.
Thank you, Doctor, and thank you, Ray, for your extra duties.
Thank you.
My question is about... You're very welcome. My question is, I love the show Forensic Files. I was just curious if you have a favorite anecdote from your professional associations or yourself consulting either with prosecution or defense in court or, a sort of mystery scenario. And my follow-up question is, are people who are driving more than 45 miles an hour today crazy or irresponsible?
Now you're getting to the crux of it. All right, doctor.
Let's see. I'm not familiar with any diagnoses that have driving in snow at above the revised speed limit as a criterion. You know, we sometimes use a word like crazy in ways that I think what we mean is you have to be you have to have very poor judgment,
right.
And that's judgment is not limited to psychiatric disorders, although it can be a part of them. You know, your forensic files kind of question, I don't fully feel comfortable talking about some of the awful situations that have been part of my experience in being involved in forensic cases. I would say that they are often terrible stories that just are heartbreaking, and it's hard to pick your way through them. I would say that rarely do I come away from a court case feeling uplifted and hopeful, but that did happen in the suit that I mentioned, the Witt versus United Behavioral Health class action, in which I testified, because I thought the judge made a decision that has the potential to transform the way that millions of people get access to care. And that's a happy ending rather than a really interesting forensic files kind of a mystery. But it was an unusual event for me, because these are often unhappy situations regardless of the outcome. This was one where I thought, oh, this court is finding something that may be of use to people who need help desperately. And the case isn't fully finished and there'll be an appeal, but I certainly felt like there was reason for hope in the aftermath of that verdict.
Well, Jason, thank you for the call. Are there any cases, doctor, in your entire career that are so either disturbing or perplexing that they keep you up at night?
Not last night, not
good,
the night
good.
Before. There obviously are times when either in treating someone or, well, maybe it isn't obvious, but it's obvious to me, either in treating someone or in being involved in a forensic matter, the entire story is so stressful and overwhelming and the stakes so high that, of course, it can get under one's skin. But you know what we're trained to do, not only psychiatrists but all mental health professionals, is to try to let ourselves react and be observing ourselves in our reaction and trying to make sense of the reaction. You know, when you go to your cardiologist, one of the things she or he will do is listen to your chest with a stethoscope, and you listen for the sounds, and you can make sense of things by the way the lungs sound or the heart sounds. And the way that mental health professionals work is our stethoscope is our own feelings. We listen to what's been mobilized in us. Are we frightened? Are we angry? Are we sad? And then we try to make sense of how does that functioning as a stethoscope to give us a clue about what's going on in this patient?
Now, that's subjective, though.
Skill.
Right? I mean, so you're filtering this through your own subjective impressions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why it's important to be as knowledgeable as you can be about what your own biases are, your own blind spots. Mm. So to do psychoanalytic work, for example, of the sort that we do at Austin Riggs, everyone who's a therapist here has been through an extensive personal psychoanalytic experience, specifically with the hope of, you know, being able to sort out what's just me, what's my own stuff versus what am I picking up that's a noise coming through the stethoscope.
Hmm. Now, would psychoanalysis by committee then be more effective?
That sounds frightening.
In other words, you have three people and they perhaps all have slightly different reactions, but wouldn't there then be a way to not average the three, but sort of get a consensus?
No, I don't think the issue is to achieve a consensus. I think the issue is to put together a highly subjective understanding of this person's inner world.
Mm.
And that requires a certain kind of listening skill that takes into account as much as possible what the patient brings to the picture. The idea isn't to create the truth in the sense of the way allegedly a trial is to find a verdict that is accurate. The idea is to not to find the truth so much as to help this person get hold of their story in a way that they can own it and live a life with what they're carrying.
All right, let's jump.
It is highly subjective.
Let's jump back to the calls. Dr. Eric Plakin is our guest from the Austin Riggs Center, and Mark in Schoharie is next. Mark.
Yes, good afternoon, and thanks for taking our calls. I have a relative who's type 1 bipolar, and over the last several years, the manic episodes have been getting more frequent. And the previous manic episode, I took a NAMI class and plunged into it to be educated. And when the current manic episode that he's just gone through was 6 months, it was a 6 month extremely manic period. We saw that one coming, and I couldn't stop the train wreck. It's never been that everybody automatically assumes they go off their meds and then they become manic. And with him is, he becomes manic, and it's not until while he's on his meds, and then he stops taking his meds and self-medicating. So my question is, how can we prevent this when we see it coming? Because of HIPAA laws and everything else, it's difficult to talk to doctors involved. I had all the proper paperwork for permissions to talk to doctors, but as the situation changes, the doctors change. And, he was in, he gave me permission to have him put into a mental health unit. We did that, and he was released, and he was still manic when he was released. He got arrested within a couple of hours of being released. And that happened three times. Once was a 16-day stay, and once was a 5-day stay, and the last time was only a 3-day stay. And each time he was released, manic. And yeah. Each time he did arrested. He's currently incarcerated.
All right. We only have about 90 seconds for the doctor to give you an answer here.
Okay. Okay. Sorry.
What an awful situation, Mark. So bipolar disorder is the current name for what used to be called manic depressive illness. There are episodes of mania and depression. It sounds like this person where you couldn't stop the train, it sounds like he breaks through his medications. It sounds like whatever he's taking isn't enough to contain him, and then once he starts to have the manic episode, then he stops the medications, and that's like pouring gasoline on the flame that's already ignited. Then you talk about this issue of he's kept in treatment only long enough, really a minimal period of time, and when he's released, he's still manic. This is what I was addressing in an earlier reference to the importance of this lawsuit that doesn't limit keeping people in treatment, that is paying for it by an insurance company, to somebody being in crisis. It sounds like he's someone for whom the crisis subsided somewhat. He gets discharged. Within a few hours, he's arrested. And this, you said, happened three different times. If he had treatment...
He's very intelligent. The big picture, talks his way out.
Well, if he had treatment that recognized that there's more than just the immediate problem, and he could be engaged in treatment for a longer period of time, there's hope that he'd have better outcomes. But unfortunately, we're often building treatments just around crisis stabilization, because that for 25 or 30 years has been all that insurance companies would pay for. That's not adequate care.
Dr. Eric Plakin, how do people find out more about the Austin Riggs Center?
Well, a good way is the website, as I mentioned, www.austinriggs.org. That's AustenRiggs.org. Website has a lot of information about Riggs in our centennial year, and we're looking forward to the next century.
Well, thank you very much for being here. We are about out of time. Support comes from Retired Public Employees Association, working in the interest of retirees from New York State and local governments. You earned your retirement. RPEA protects it. Learn more at rpea.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Eric Plakin for joining us today. Thank you for some very thoughtful questions. And tomorrow on the program, I won't even tell you that yet. It's very exciting. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Our calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Now, you ready? Tomorrow on the show, Mark Lawson will be here to answer your antique questions. All right? So write it down. Go up to the attic. Dust something off. Give us a call tomorrow at 2. Stand by now for the Media Project.